Forget about home for the holidays. It is Christmas in jail for the former Minnesota police officer who mistook her gun for a taser. Probably many Christmases in jail for Kim Potter. Plus, still another woman accuses Chris Noth of sexual assault. And James Franco comes clean about his own sexual addiction. Also ahead, a horrific murder that left a single mother dead and her two young children wounded is getting a second look. There are now serious doubts that the man who spent three decades behind bars for the crime is the real killer. But if it's not him, who is it? And policing in America, how many of you watching at home could face a situation just like this in your jobs?
I'm not gonna shoot your ass.
Well, it is all in a day's work for so many of the 800,000 law enforcement officials across our country. It's all tonight on Banfield. Good evening and welcome to Banfield Tonight. I'm Marnie Hughes in tonight for Ashley. For the second time this year, a Minnesota jury has convicted a Minnesota police officer of killing a suspect. Kim Potter likely faces a decade or more in prison for the death last April of Dante Wright in a traffic stop gone horribly wrong. Potter and the rookie officer she was training had pulled Wright over for an expired tag. And when he resisted and tried to break away, Potter threatened to tase him, but shot him instead. And if you have been following this trial, you know Potter cried on the witness stand and her lawyer told the jury a mistake isn't a crime. Still, after 27 hours of deliberations, jurors found her guilty of first and second degree manslaughter. And the judge refused to let her spend Christmas at home. Reaction outside the court, not mixed.
Find the defendant guilty.
For his part, Minnesota's attorney general, who also oversaw the conviction of Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd, said Potter isn't a bad person. She just did a bad thing.
I think it's a good sign that she was remorseful. I mean, what decent person wouldn't be brokenhearted and sad if they were involved in something like this? So I wish nothing but the best for her and her family. But the truth is, she will be able to correspond with them and visit with them no matter what happens. But the Wrights won't be able to talk to Dante.
An emotional day for many. Joining me now with their insights on all of this are the famed criminal defense attorney and podcaster Mark Garagos and former homicide detective and host of Murder Chose Me on Investigation Discovery, Rodney Demery. Gentlemen, we appreciate your time tonight. Mark, I'd like to start with you. They not only announced the verdict in open court, they also announced the exact day and time that they were reached. We learned that the juries agreed on second degree charge Tuesday morning, the same day they told the judge that they may have been deadlocked. Clearly, they were struggling on that first degree manslaughter charge. Do you think they got this right? Was the charge appropriate?
Well, I will tell you that I'm frankly shocked. I thought that she clearly had committed a mistake based on her reaction. I thought that normally jurors are going to give officers the benefit of the doubt. And so to me, this was a shocking verdict. I thought at worst she was facing a second degree. Shame on me because I was wrong.
Rodney, were you surprised?
Not really. My thought is that, you know, police officers have two responsibilities. The first being is being in control of yourself, and the second, your firearm. Although it was a tragic mistake, and I really feel for her and her family, the reality is that because she was not in control of those two elements, this is what happened.
The jury had a lot to consider here. Rodney, it's a mistake, not necessarily malice, to confuse your gun with your taser, but we don't hear of it happening all that often. Why not?
Well, because it doesn't happen that often. You know, there are things that are in place to stop this from happening. And the first is training. You know, you train and you train and you train some more until you get it right. The reality is that police officers don't have the luxury of making mistakes. Mistakes get people killed. Although it was an accident or a mistake or something that she did that wasn't intentional, the reality is that she's in control of those two different things, herself and that firearm. And eventually or ultimately, she's held responsible for it.
It was an interesting strategy, Mark. I'd like to get your thoughts on the defense saying that Dante Wright caused his own death by refusing to comply with police. Is it ever a good idea to go after the victim who was killed when you're trying a police officer on the stand?
Well, remember, one of the things supposedly they pulled him over because of an air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror. That irritates people. I mean, I know what that's like. For 40 years, I've been hearing people complain about kind of these ticky-tack fouls, so to speak. That may have, you may have hit on why they kind of took it out on her. But remember, she testified when they asked her, if it was just you, would you have pulled him over? And she said no, which I thought was a good answer, frankly. And one of the reasons I say, and I still say, I'm kind of so very surprised by this verdict.
Well, and the question remains, if a taser even would have been necessary, what do you think, Mr. Demery? Would that have even been an adequate option?
You know, that's probably one of the toughest parts of this case. The reality is it's all on the officer. The fact that there's no sense of situational awareness to even know what's going on, whether or not you should have a taser or a firearm, is a problem. And looking at the legal side of it or the social side of it, you know, that's one thing. But as a police officer, there's just some things that are just you have to know. You know, and you have to know what's around you. You have to know what you're doing. You have to know what's happening. Are you in danger? Is the other person in danger? It's a life death situation. She had no clue. And in my opinion, I think that's probably the reason for this. I mean, if you don't know what's going on, you have a firearm, you have a taser. Do I have my gun? Do I have my taser? Someone's dead. Yeah, this is going to happen.
And Kim Potter, clearly emotional on the stand, remorseful about what happened. What if she had merely claimed, I feared for my life. I feared that I was in danger, and that is why I did what I did. Mark, would the outcome be any different?
No, because basically she took they kind of embraced the defense of others. She said she was afraid. She testified she had seen the face of her partner officer out there, and she was afraid, and that's why she acted the way she did. I think to some degree, when you step back from this, people say, wait a second, you pulled this guy over because he had the air freshener. You then started to hassle him. You then said, okay, he had a misdemeanor warrant out. Given this milieu and given where we are in America today, I just think why are you shooting? Even if it had been a taser instead of a gun, that seems to me to be too much force. I'm just surprised because, you know, doing this for so long, generally jurors give officers a wide berth when it comes to these kinds of decisions. Man, we're in a whole new era.
What if this trial had happened in a different city? Same outcome?
I think if this had happened 5 years ago, virtually anywhere else, she never would have been convicted, is my opinion.
Rodney, how does this change policing, in particular the use of deadly force moving forward? What are the implications on a larger scale for departments across the country?
I think police officers and police departments are going to really emphasize training. They're going to learn that it's not necessarily, as Ms. Gergos just pointed out, you know, in a different time and in different places, these things happen. But I think officers and departments are going to be aware that, you know, you're responsible for your actions. Long gone are the days where you're in a position where people can have sympathy before you're even charged. I think this is when something actually goes to a jury and you're going to be held accountable. So, yeah, it's a tough situation.
Mark, I'm curious your opinion as a defense attorney, what advice you would give Kim Potter. Many wonder what prison is like for a police officer. What would you tell her to prepare for?
Well, I would have told her, look, if you get convicted, you're getting remanded, meaning you're going straight into jail. No judge is going to let her be out over the Christmas holidays after she's been convicted. And by the way, she's going to be sequestered. She's going to have a very tough time. It's not a good place for her to be. And I will tell you, I have seen cases much more egregious than this years ago, where it didn't even make it past a probable cause proceeding, meaning a preliminary hearing. Judges just dismissed it. Generally, all you got to do if you're an officer is say, I feared for my life or I feared for another officer's life. Officer safety becomes kind of the buzzword, and that's all she wrote. I mean, this is truly a watershed event when it comes to officers. I mean, Chauvin was a different situation, to me at least. That was somebody who was, I mean, the deliberate indifference for 9 minutes with your knee on somebody's neck, that wasn't tough. That wasn't a tough call. This woman clearly was upset in real time, clearly took the stand and was upset, and clearly had made a mistake with no intent. And that's by definition why it's a manslaughter, not a murder. It's somewhat shocking for somebody in the criminal justice system to see her get convicted. And by the way, 2 days before, 3 days before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. What about a civil trial? What happens next?
Oh, it's done. In terms of civil liability, once she's been convicted of the criminal case, that's beyond a reasonable doubt. The civil is a lesser standard. This becomes res judicata or collateral estoppel, and the civil, they're just going to have to write a check at this point.
Rodney, how about accountability? We heard the district attorney talk about this is the first step in accountability. In terms of this department in particular, what types of things will they be doing internally to address what happened moving forward and focus particularly on training their officers? I was surprised to hear her on the stand say that she hadn't been trained on the taser versus the gun.
Yeah, and that's the other side of the coin. Police departments are required to train their police officers. And when they take that lackadaisical approach and you know, training here and there every now and then, it shows. And I think now it's going to be, especially on the civil side of it, they're going to realize that liability is really great. So they're going to have to train those officers and have to make sure they're aware of what they're doing. You know, again, I can't speak about situational awareness enough, you know, mental being mentally fit for the job and actually training with your weapon and your taser so you can develop a muscle memory to understand which one you're using. That's a lack of training. That's short and simple. They just don't train. So I think this is going to turn that into a situation where people train.
How about the other side of that, though? If somebody is committing a crime, are they more likely to confront police knowing that police could potentially be fearful of doing the wrong thing and having an outcome as this?
Yeah, absolutely. But again, you know, the responsibility or the onus is on the police department, the police officer. You're going to run into all types of people that don't want to go to jail, that have committed crimes, that don't want to be taken into custody. But the reality is that it's your responsibility to know what comes out of that firearm and where that bullet's going and whether or not you should actually shoot. She didn't even know if she was in a life or death situation. She clearly thought that it wasn't a life or death situation because she claimed she drew a taser. So when you have all these different factors, when she's completely oblivious to what's going on, regardless of what the suspect is doing or not doing, it's still your responsibility to have control of that scene.
It's a tragedy all around for all involved. Mark, thank you as always. And Rodney, stick around. We're going to be talking with you in just a little bit. Thank you both.
Absolutely.
I want to remind everybody who is watching that other big trial, of course, of Ghislaine Maxwell, that jurors there are on break until after Christmas. Deliberations started late Monday in the sex trafficking case against the former girlfriend and right-hand woman of Jeffrey Epstein. If convicted, she could spend the rest of her life in prison. Meantime, there is another lurid allegation against Chris Noth, the actor best known for his long-running roles on TV's Law & Order and also Sex and the City. Accuser number 4 is the first so far to tell her story. On camera, she told it this afternoon in a virtual news conference alongside her powerful and well-known attorney, Gloria Allred. Lisa Gentile says that she was a singer in New York City in 2002 when Noth befriended her at a restaurant where they both were hanging out. One night, she says Noth offered her a ride home and asked to come inside.
He started kissing me almost right away. Then he leaned against the kitchen countertop and forcibly pulled me against him. He was slobbering all over me. I quickly became uncomfortable. Then he became more aggressive and put both hands on my breasts and began squeezing them very hard over my shirt. He quickly went under my shirt and began squeezing them even harder over my bra, with his fingers grabbing the exposed skin not covered by my bra. Then he pushed my bra up with both of his hands. I grabbed his hands with my hands and tried to stop him. I kept pushing his hands down while he was pushing mine up. I was trying to get him to stop. Then he forced my hands to pull up his shirt, exposing his belly. And then even harder, he pushed my hands down toward his penis. I finally managed to push him away and get out of his grasp and yelled, "No, I don't want this." He became extremely angry and started screaming and calling me a tease and a bitch. He stormed out of my apartment. After he left, I woke up my roommate and best friend and I told her what had happened. She clearly remembers this. The next morning, he called me on my roommate's phone, her landline, that was not in my name. He warned me that if I ever told a soul about what happened the night before, that he would ruin my career, that I would never sing again, and that he would blacklist me in the business.
A very detailed account. Noth has not yet responded to this latest allegation, but when the first two claims hit a week ago, he said, in part, "I don't know for certain why they are surfacing now, but I do know this. I did not assault these women." Joining me now to break all of this down are PR and crisis management expert Evan Nierman and clinical psychologist John Duffy. Appreciate both of your time tonight on the program. Evan, I'd like to start with you. What can and should Noth be doing right now, the damage control?
Well, if he truly is innocent and he did not assault these women, then he needs to be very clear and very forceful in decrying these accusations, setting the record straight, and not allowing his accusers to drive the narrative in its entirety. He's in a tough spot at the moment because she clearly has very competent and very media savvy legal counsel, and she's getting her side of the story out there. So if he waits too long and he doesn't set the record straight, then he cedes the ground to her, and then he's digging himself out of an even bigger hole.
And what do you think of his comments so far?
Well, the comment that you just had on the screen was pretty definitive and pretty declarative. He said he didn't do it. So it's hard to argue that he could have been more clear than that. I think it was succinct. It was to the point, and it got his message out.
Let me ask you, when one person comes out, he denies it. When two people come out, he denies it. How many more people come out? Does he deny it each time? What is the approach in a situation like this, if you were advising him?
Well, the more people who come out of the woodwork to make accusations, the harder it is to say no. If it's one person, okay. But when you get two, three, four, people tend to believe where there's smoke, there's fire. So it becomes a much, much tougher accusation because you're looking at not a he said, she said type of event, but you're looking at a possibility of a systematic approach, a pattern of behavior that is completely unacceptable. And I think what this shows is in the era of Me Too, men in powerful positions are not necessarily given the benefit of the doubt. And it is actually, I think, to the benefit of society overall that people are put on notice that taking these kinds of actions, whether these allegations are true or not, we don't yet know. But for men to believe that the good old days where they could just act with impunity on someone in a position of lesser power, those days are over. And I think that's a good thing.
Right. But these allegations are from years ago. So, Dr. Duffy, let me bring you in here. The first two accusers said they came forward because it sparked some memories for them when they saw the reboot of the Sex and the City. And that is why they came forward all these years later. Are you surprised that once one victim comes forward, another victim feels empowered to? What is the psychological impact that seeing that has on people?
Yeah, I'm not surprised, Marnie, to be honest with you. You know, we have to keep in mind that sexual assault itself is an incredibly traumatic event in the first place. And to then have it relived years later or to hear about somebody else suffering sexual assault by the same person, it's kind of reliving that trauma. And then there's this question, and then I think that question is kind of evident in the soundbite we first saw here about whether you're going to be believed or not if you come forward. So there are a number of questions that any victim, male or female, needs to ask themselves before they come forward. And I think the other element that's important to recognize is it's not incumbent upon victims to come forward. So they do this voluntarily. And I'm not surprised in the end that it's taken some time for some of these women to come forward, and that the reboot of this show has been maybe the impetus to do so.
But the question remains, why not come forward sooner? Why not raise red flags? I mean, he has been acting for years. He's been in the public eye. What goes into that decision, or what challenges keep people from speaking out as soon as it happens?
A lot of it has to do with whether or not you're going to be believed. But an awful lot of people who've been through sexual trauma of some kind or another don't necessarily want to come forward. There are a number of elements. They don't necessarily want to be a poster child for this type of thing. They don't want their name in public or to be known for being victimized in this type of way. So I think there's a number of things that victims need to take into account, oftentimes working with a therapist. And sometimes people in my field are encouraging of coming forward, that this is going to be empowering and healing to you. Sometimes we would discourage it and say, you know what, this is your business. It is reasonable for you to keep this under wraps. So that's what we recommend. So it's oftentimes working with a therapist that drives whether somebody comes forward or not.
Emotionally charged. Real quick, and I want to get on to the next topic, but Evan, is he done? I mean, we've seen many people in Hollywood, when something like this happens, folks distance themselves from them. How does he come out of this professionally?
Too early to tell. For him right now, too early to tell, but it's not looking good at the moment.
Welcome back to Banfield. I'm Marnie Hughes in for Ashley tonight. The Joanne Tate killing was one of the most horrific murders in St. Louis history, and it continues to make headlines even today. Tate's body was found in a pool of blood in her own home in April of 1982. Her two children, 4 and 7 years old, were home at the time, and they too were repeatedly stabbed by the killer. They survived, and one of them was able to identify a suspect. That man, Rodney Lincoln, was convicted, serving more than 30 years behind bars, until in 2018, DNA testing showed he was likely not the killer, and the governor commuted his sentence. But if Lincoln didn't commit these crimes, who did? The search for the real killer is the focus of a new true crime podcast. And here's a preview of the series.
I'm only writing this all down in case something would happen to me.
An ominous premonition ends up coming true.
I could see my sister laying in the middle room with no clothes on, with an object sticking out of her.
One of the most violent and vicious crimes in St. Louis history.
This was a front page, headline grabbing homicide.
A single mother brutally murdered in her own home.
It was a horrible crime, made all the more horrible by the fact that there were these two little girls who had watched it happen and then been tortured themselves.
One of those young girls survives and IDs the suspect.
He killed my mom, tried to kill me and my sister.
The accused killer sent to prison. End of story, right? Not even close.
I don't know how he got there. He was never there.
Changing stories.
Does memory get better with time? Oh, your memory's better now? No.
A man who claims he's innocent.
Hey, you got me confused with someone else. I did not do that.
And a mission to find out the truth.
If you could ask anything, what would you ask him?
Are you the real killer?
Chilling. And after the break, I'm going to be joined by Leah Rothman, the host of that Real Killer podcast. I'm going to ask her who she thinks killed Joanne Tate and if she believes that person is still out there. That's next. Welcome back to Banfield Tonight. I'm Marnie Hughes in for Ashley. The question, who killed Joanne Tate and repeatedly stabbed her two young children, remains tonight. For more than three decades, most people were convinced it was this man, Rodney Lincoln. A former lover of Tate's, he was convicted of the crime and spent more than 36 years behind bars. But in 2018, his life sentence was commuted by the governor after DNA testing cast real doubt on his involvement in the crime. Now more and more people are trying to piece this together and figure out who really committed the murder. The search for Joanne Tate's murderer is the focus of a new podcast entitled The Real Killer. And I'm joined tonight by the host of that podcast and series, Leah Rothman. Leah, we appreciate your time tonight. So take me back to the beginning of this case. Remind people of the evidence. Why did police believe that Rodney Lincoln was the killer?
Right. So in 1982, when the murder happened, 7-year-old Melissa was really the only eyewitness who could help police. And a month later, she ends up IDing one of her mom's ex-boyfriends, Rodney Lincoln. And basically, her identification and then a hair on a blue blanket that they said microscopically matched Rodney was really the crux of the evidence that they had against Rodney at that time.
And what does she say now about what she shared with police identifying him then? Does she still stick with that story?
No. In 2015, she recanted. And she, you know, she had some of these feelings over the years, but she was too afraid to really pay attention to that voice inside of her. And in 2015, she came out and said, I got it wrong, he didn't do it, and we've got to let this man out. Unfortunately, a lot of people didn't want to believe her.
Is there still a chance he is the killer? Where is Rodney Lincoln tonight?
Rodney Lincoln is out. In 2018, Governor Eric Greitens commuted his sentence to time served. He is still considered guilty of the crimes, but he's out. And the search is, you know, who is the real killer? And that's what we ask in the Real Killer podcast. Who is the real killer? Mm-hmm. There are people in the Missouri court system that still believe Rodney is the real killer. And there are other people out there, many people out there, that believe it's not him and it's two people. There are two names that are at the top of the list of who could be the real killer.
Right.
And I actually get an exclusive interview with one of them.
Who's that?
Well, I can't share his name right now. I hate to say you have to listen to the podcast, but before folks, I know I would love to share it.
Well, let me jump in then, because we do know there was a serial killer at the time. Tommy Lynn Sells. He moved to St. Louis just before the murder. The crime scene resembled some of his killings. So what is your theory about who did it?
You know, it's a good question. I think it could be, a lot seems to point to Tommy Lynn Sells. A lot seems to possibly point to this other person that I speak to who's currently incarcerated. Tommy Lynn Sells had a very similar MO, like you said. He was from the St. Louis area. There are questions about where he was at the time of the murder. Some believe he was locked up in a youth detention facility. Others say not so fast. So I believe it could be one of these two people. And these are some of the questions that we ask in the podcast.
A lot of questions around this mystery, a tragic story that involved this poor family, a woman killed and her daughters severely injured and there to witness this. Really interesting, Leah. We appreciate your time tonight, and we'll have to listen to hear who you talk to. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
All right, coming up, when officers have a bead on their man and then this happens, they've got their eye on him. Watch.
Ranger vehicle in pursuit.
Uh-oh, policing in America. That's next. Welcome back. Well, they say football, basketball, baseball, they are games of inches. A fraction of an inch could mean a Super Bowl victory or a defeat. Well, in policing, an inch, a split-second decision, or even a little bit of luck could mean the difference between life and death. We've seen it play out. Back with us tonight, Rodney Demery, former homicide detective and host of Murder Chose Me on Investigation Discovery. Also joining us, Andrea Zendeja, a.k.a. the Bun of Justice. Andrea served with the city of El Paso, Texas, while on the force. And finally, Chad Ayers. He is a former team leader with Greenville, South Carolina SWAT. We appreciate you all being here tonight. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, so this first piece of video I want to share with folks at home, shots fired at an officer, a suspect for that matter, both lucky to be alive after what you're going to see happen. This is in Oklahoma City, where Officer Andrew Ash is responding to the call of a disturbance upon arrival. He crossed paths with 40-year-old Antoine Hill, who appears nervous. He's jittery. He is constantly reaching into his pocket. And this, of course, we know is a recipe for disaster. Let's take a look at what happens.
Can I receive what you have? Okay, put it down on the ground.
Wait, y'all, wait! Shh. You're a rookie. You don't know. You're a rookie. Go.
Okay, stay right there. Do not move. Stay right there.
What?
Just stay over there.
Please, sir. Please. Please don't do that.
73, I got a guy with a gun. I'm not doing anything. Look, I'm not doing... Don't shoot.
I'm not.
I'm finna shoot your...
Drop the gun.
I don't have it. Look. I don't have it. Shots fired.
Wow, it's scary, and it happened in a second. Hill was arrested for felony pointing a firearm, possession of a firearm after a former felony conviction. Andrea, I want to get your take on this. Take us to school, what you see happen and play out.
Well, first of all, when I watched this video, I was ducking and bopping and weaving because I just seen that, you know, all you see is the barrel of that gun. Luckily, I mean, thank God, neither one of them were killed. But the officer had every right to protect himself if it would have come to that. I mean, it didn't, but it made me nervous just watching it. I was kind of like I was there.
Doesn't it bring up the question about deadly force? Chad, let me bring you in here. I mean, clearly his life was in danger. He had a gun pointed right at him. What did the officer do right here in that split second decision where his training comes into play?
I mean, I'm going to come out and say, unfortunately, I don't feel like this was a training scar. He picked up on the firearm while they were still in that breezeway of that apartment complex. He said he's got a gun. He saw the gun. I'm not here to Monday morning quarterback anybody, but, you know, at the end of the day, I think this is a training lesson for some people to realize that this job isn't for everyone. And that's not wrong. There's sometimes you get into professions and you realize this isn't for me. I just thank God this guy, and I hope that he hit his knees when he got home, and he is so lucky to be alive. But, you know, Marnie, I think that a lot of this can kind of go back to, I think a lot of these guys are so worried about being the next law enforcement officer's face plastered across the news outlets across America right now, that they're scared to use force, even when they're justified in a situation like this.
Really scary. And either one of them could have ended up shot or dead. Let me bring you in, Rodney, real quick on this one. What's your take?
Yeah, I think obviously it was a very scary situation, but I think the officer did a great job. I mean, he created distance. He tried to de-escalate with his voice, and he was evasive enough not to get hit. Thank God.
All right, we got another one for you guys. Let's weigh in on this. Outside Cincinnati, 87-year-old Pat Goines is grocery shopping when a man clearly on the naughty list decides to snatch her purse, and then he makes his getaway. He did not count on a good Samaritan, though, and a speedster, Deshaun Presley, springing into action, and you see him there. Deshaun pretty much has his way with the purse snatcher, getting a few extra swings for good measure before fellow shoppers help him come out. They helped Deshaun hold him down until police arrive and make the arrest. It all led to this moment when Deshaun was presented with a certificate of bravery from the Butler County Sheriff's Office.
You took and made what we call a citizen's arrest, and you make us very, very proud. Everybody, just not here, but everybody in the country, man.
Yeah.
And we're proud of you, and I mean that. And thank you for what you've done.
All right.
Good morning, man.
So hold on to that right there, and they can get you a little picture of that.
Come right on over
there. Proud of you, man.
You guys are right in there. Is that a picture or what, folks?
All right.
Hey, all right.
Well, we need more Deshauns out there, but he could have been hurt. Chad, let's get your thoughts on this one. Really risky business going after people, but he saved the day in the end.
I tell you what, several things that I can't stand as a thief and someone that messes with old people and children. This guy did two of those three. I think they ended up saying this. The victim was in her 80s. And this gentleman here just sprung into action. I'm telling you, I wish I had him as a partner back in the day. But sure, there's risk involved in taking action like this. But, you know, obviously this guy knew his ability and saved the day. Kudos to this guy. You know, give him another award.
Dirty, rotten scoundrel. And he didn't just hold him there. He kept kicking him. And when he was down, he kicked him again. Andrea, what are your thoughts on this one? And I'll give you the final word.
This is simply a good Samaritan taking care of business. That's exactly what this is. And thank God for him.
All right. We'll leave it there. Rodney, Andrea, and Chad, thank you all so much for joining us. I'd like to end on a good one when it ends that way. I appreciate your time tonight. You guys have a Merry Christmas, okay?
Merry Christmas.
Good morning.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Still to come here on Banfield, we are tracking criminals, and we're going to end with tracking Santa. Every year, NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, turns a few of its radars and satellites towards the North Pole to keep tabs on jolly old Saint Nick. It's fun for the kids, but why do they do this? We've got the answer after the break.